Welcome to Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, a series of lectures bringing the classroom to you. For the next several weeks, this radio station, in cooperation with Franciscan University of Steubenville, will present a course on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church. Your professor, Father Giles Dimmock, a Dominican priest, has 29 years of teaching experience and is currently chairman of the theology department at Franciscan University of Steubenville. For more information on Franciscan University of Steubenville's distance education program, call 1-800-446-8336. Or from outside of the United States, call 614-283-6517. And now, here is Father Giles Dimmock with this week's lecture on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church.
Now, we're looking at the sacrament of marriage. And I'm going to give you a little bit of the history of the sacrament before we get into the present rite. It's clear, if you read St. Paul, that the early Christians thought that marriage, and St. Paul keeps using this expression, in the Lord is holy. It's not clear to us, however, that they had any special rite. In other words, it seems that they simply followed whatever the local customs were. What made Christian marriage different from other marriage was that it was in the Lord, namely two baptized people getting married. Okay? Now, the early fathers of the church really stressed the dignity of marriage because many of the fathers had so stressed the importance of virginity that some people were looking down on marriage. And so, for example, the veil that women wear, still do, a lot of brides anyway, a veil. Well, that was the veil of the virgin, and the fathers of the church encouraged brides to wear a veil to kind of show that their matrimonial status as a wife had great dignity too, okay? So to show the dignity of the married woman. Now, what began to happen in the early patristic period is that marriages began to be blessed by the bishop. And in fact, sometimes in close-knit communities, the bishop being the father of the local community, people would get his permission to get married, okay? And then it went from that to getting his blessing. Tertullian's in the 300s, 4th century, he's one of the first ones to talk about marriage at a Eucharist. Probably it wasn't so much that they had a special wedding mass, but probably at the Sunday gathering where they all were there celebrating mass together, then a couple would have their vows blessed by the bishop. That's the first instance we have. But in Rome, it more from the 5th century on, people began to be married at Mass, have their marriage blessed. Now, remember that we, in the beginning of the class, what do we say that the attitude of the fathers of the church was in terms of how many sacraments there were? There were lots, yes. At least 7, that's right, okay. With some of them, there was a bit of discussion whether or not marriage was a sacrament. Most taught marriage is a sacrament. But for some, the whole sexual dimension to it put some fathers off. And it's in the Middle Ages that the work of Peter Lombard and Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas clearly established marriage as a sacrament. It's not that the fathers of the church, many of them didn't think that it was, but it was kind of like clearly accepted by everybody that marriage is a sacrament. And it's here particularly that a special mass begins to develop. Special readings, special prayers for the people who are getting married. First, vows would be exchanged in the front of the church, and then actually in front of the altar. So there's a kind of a gradual progression that the church kind of more and more joins the celebration of the Mass to the Eucharist, to a special Eucharist. The vows are exchanged up front of the church and then eventually actually in front of the altar itself. So some of our wedding customs actually come from all over the world. Giving away the bride by the father, handing the bride over, as it were, and we see that happening. Most of the time, the bride will come down the aisle on the arm of her father. The groom is either waiting up front, or sometimes he might come down with his folks. But however it happens, usually in front of the altar, the father kind of, sort of, if you will, sort of hands the bride over to the groom. That's a Roman custom, an ancient Roman custom that got kind of baptized, if you will, and taken up. Wherever there are those gallant grooms who still carry a bride over the threshold, should there be any gallantry or gentlemanliness left in this world, should that be the case, that's an ancient Roman custom, carrying the bride over the threshold. Eating the cake, the bride feeding the groom the cake, etc., the wedding cake, that too is a Roman custom. All of these kind of pagan Roman customs that were Christianized. In Poland and in France, the priest went from the wedding ceremony and he went to the home and he blessed the marriage bed. This is not sort of an ugly and squalid part of marriage, but actually is a very beautiful and integral part, as we shall see. The consummation of the marriage is integral to the very reality of the marriage. Okay. The ring, the wedding ring, was originally a betrothal ring. And betrothal in the Middle Ages, and actually in many of the ancient rites, was very, very strong. You had to have a special dispensation to get out of a betrothal because it was almost like marriage. It was so strong that you intended to marry this person. And actually, betrothal ceremonies often, too, were kind of times of teaching. People were given new clothing and they exchanged gifts and there were prayers said. And there was a little bit like a catechumenate to some degree. I directed a doctoral dissertation of a priest for the Angelicum, and he was trying to look at the ancient rites of betrothal and then kind of draw out of that and propose a kind of model of marriage preparation for young men and women of today as a kind of gradual preparation with instruction, but also with prayers and certain symbolic stages to kind of help people get ready for the great sacrament of marriage. And not just have it all kind of like psychological or just pure instruction. And there was a great deal of merit in it. So the betrothal ring in Germany became a wedding ring. So then it was no longer the ring as a sign of betrothal, but in Germany it became the wedding ring, and that became a universal custom. Okay. Finally, insofar as people kiss at weddings, we are not surprised that that custom comes from the Romantic Spaniards. Okay. And the nuptial blessing is something that developed in the Roman tradition. Yes, Kathy.
My question is about, I have read that before Vatican II, there wasn't a kiss at weddings, and now they do it as a sign of peace instead of like, now you may kiss the bride as
Protestants do. That's interesting. I don't know. But Spaniards did it as a part of the ceremony. Yeah. It might have disappeared, indeed, as the kiss of peace disappeared. The kiss of peace disappeared in the late patristic period, or the sign of peace at Mass, and it was not revived until the Second Vatican Council. It was kept vestigially at a solemn Mass, where the priest gave it to the deacon, who gave it to the subdeacon, who gave it to the acolytes, and in monastic choirs, and it used to be in the Dominican rite, the acolytes would come over and they would hand out what was called an Agnus Dei, a little image of Christ as the Lamb of God. And then what would happen is, rather than giving one another some sort of sign of peace, these little images would be passed out, and all of the religious in the sanctuary area would kiss that, pass it to the next one, kiss that. so the Kiss of Peace ended up in that kind of vestigial way. And I suppose that what happened is that the wedding kiss kind of disappeared when the general Kiss of Peace disappeared. Okay, now what's the rite now? Okay, well, for practicing Catholics, the rite normally takes place during Mass, okay? Because all of the sacraments, as we've seen, St. Thomas reiterates again and again, point towards the Eucharist. In the Eucharist, Jesus gives himself to the bride, the church, and therefore it's fitting. However, if perchance you're marrying, let's say, a Protestant, it tends not normally to make a great deal of sense to have a whole Mass, precisely because you'd be not sharing with the groom or the bride, the Protestant party, the Eucharist, so that the Catholic party could receive Holy Communion and the non-Catholic party couldn't. So that in a sense you'd be drawing attention to the very thing that you cannot share. Whereas if you have it in the context of a liturgy of the word, which is actually recommended and required, then to some degree, you, even though there are differences in understanding the word, nonetheless you can both share in the word. Now, for us in the West, when I say in the West, I mean the Roman Catholic Church. I'm not talking about the Byzantine Catholic Church. I'm talking about the Roman Catholic Church. The spouses are the ministers, okay? The bride and the groom who face one another and covenant themselves to each other with the vows, they are the ones performing the ceremony. They are the ministers. Jesus Christ is working through them and expressing their consent before the church, okay? Now, it's true that the priest is supposed to be there as a witness. Sometimes in mission countries, someone else can be delegated, like a catechist or something like that, okay? But it is based because it is the couple themselves. In the Eastern tradition, this is not so. In the Eastern tradition, both Catholic and Orthodox, the priest must be there. And after he receives their consent, he crowns them. And that blessing and crowning is considered essential to the ceremony. If you've ever gone to an Orthodox ceremony or seen it on television, I think, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina was being, BBC production of that was being broadcast over public television. It was a beautiful wedding ceremony, and the best man stands behind the couple and he holds these crowns over their head. They're a royal couple. They're members of the royal priesthood. They're cooperating with God, the Creator, and procreating and bringing new life into the world. And that for them is actually an essential part of the ceremony. Okay. Now the consent, first of all, for a sacrament, we're talking about two baptized. If you fall in love with a Muslim, let's say, you're on mission in Algiers, okay, the church will bless that marriage, but it is not considered a sacrament. If you go to work in the Big Apple, and then you work in the garment district, and you fall in love with a Jew, the church will bless that marriage, but it is not a sacrament, because the two people are not, one is baptized, but the other is not. Okay? Two Catholics who marry, it is a sacrament. A Catholic and an Orthodox, it is a sacrament. Two Orthodox, it is a sacrament. A Catholic and a Protestant, it is a sacrament. Two Protestants who are baptized, it is a sacrament, even though they probably don't see it that way. Nonetheless, whenever there are two baptized, it is a sacrament, the sign of the great love that Jesus has for the church. Okay? But if it is not, if one of them is not baptized, or both of them is not baptized, there might be much to be said about a marriage that is good on the natural level, but it is not sacramental. Okay. So, to baptize, and there must be free consent. Shotgun marriages are invalid. Okay. So the father of the bride is really upset because the bride is pregnant and the young man is forced down the aisle against his will. There's no way that that can be a valid sacrament because it is not a free sacrament. Frequently, the church is not anxious to marry people in a situation like that because sometimes forced into a situation to perhaps simply to give the child a good name or something like that, there really isn't any kind of depth of commitment and the marriage may well break down. Much better, in a sense, for the couple to really think it through and see if they really want to spend the rest of their lives with this other person. Now, sometimes it can well be that the couple really do love one another deeply and they really want to. They just got a bit carried away. Okay, well, that's probably a good risk. But if not, the church is not necessarily anxious just to kind of marry people in difficult situations. You know, they really need to think it through because this is a lifelong commitment. There's a very interesting case, the Vanderbilts, the wealthy Vanderbilts. They hit the New York society scene, and of course all of these wealthy steel magnates and railroad magnates, industrial magnates, they had all of this money, these millionaires. But they didn't have titles. They didn't have connection to European royalty. So Mrs. Vanderbilt wanted her daughter Consuelo to marry into European society. And so there the Duke of Marlborough was eligible, barely. The Duke of Marlborough had all sorts of problems. They found out later he was syphilitic. Consuelo did not want to marry the Duke of Marlborough. The mother badgered her, brainwashed her, kept at her night and day, until poor Consuelo, debutante of New York, toast of the town, got married to the Duke of Marlborough, who came over from England in a glittering ceremony on St. Thomas Church, Fifth Avenue, Episcopal Church. And not surprisingly, the marriage fell apart. She fell in love later with Marconi. Marconi is the man who invented the radio. Established the radio at the Vatican, Vatican Radio. He was made a papal count. And he wanted to know if he could get married to Consuelo. Now, she had been married in the Episcopal Church to the Duke of Marlborough. They were both Episcopalians, or Anglicans, as they're called in England. They were both baptized, therefore it was a sacrament, or was it? Well, the church said no, it wasn't, because she was not free. Well, you can imagine, the Episcopalians get very upset, and the Protestants, what's this dreadful old Church of Rome interfering in our business, declaring a good Protestant ceremony not valid? That had nothing to do with it. They were declaring it not valid because she was not free. And then she was free and to marry, therefore, papal Count Marconi. And I guess they lived happily ever after as he went around setting up radio stations. Anyway, okay. So, but the whole point is she was not free, okay? So that could be an impediment to marriage. A priest would not be free by ecclesiastical law. He might attempt marriage. Sometimes the church will give a priest a dispensation, but that means that he has to give up completely the clerical life. He has to promise not to say Mass again, not to administer the sacraments, except in a case of extreme emergency, when someone's dying or something, etc. And then sometimes the church in her mercy will allow him to marry, or more normally, he's probably already married, and if it looks like the marriage is going to last, the church will kind of validate that so that that he's not living in sin, basically. But it's a kind of a mercy. Now, basically, what we're talking about is this consent between the two baptized, the free consent, which is then consummated. In one class, I was using the word consummated, and I found out that people didn't know what I was talking about. That means have sex, natural sexual intercourse. Okay, so that, if you stop and think of it, Catholicism is very incarnational. There is the Word, but just as the eternal Word, Jesus, became flesh, the words of the couple covenanting themselves to one another is enfleshed in their sharing their bodies, the nuptial union of their bodies with one another. John Paul II's beautiful teaching on the very spousal nature of human bodies, the man's body made for woman's and woman's for man. And so the covenant that they expressed verbally, they seal in the flesh through natural sexual intercourse. It is interesting to note that the so-called Josephite marriage, why would a marriage be called Josephite? Because it's like that of Saint Joseph and Our Lady, who were truly married, but who did not have sex. Okay, so a Josephite marriage. There are times, there are couples, and it is unusual. We do not recommend, most of you who feel called to be married, that you practice this. It takes extraordinary people. But sometimes there are couples who feel, though they wish to be married, that they do not feel called to have sex. I'm not talking about contraception. I'm talking about not having a sexual intercourse. I believe this was true of Jacques-Henri Samaritain, the great philosopher, Thomistic philosopher, and his Jewish convert wife. It is true of some other couples. It is interesting to note, however, that the Church believes that it has the power to nullify such marriages because they are not complete. They may be complete, if you will, on a spiritual level. Clearly, Our Lady and Saint Joseph, on a spiritual level, had a deep understanding, a very deep union of souls. But normally, Christian marriage is not only the union of soul, but also the union of body. So that consequently, should it be that a couple, for some reason, supposing there was a very naive couple or something like that, or somehow they never quite got around to it, although it's hard to imagine such a case. If in fact that were to be proven, and the marriage didn't work out, there could be a decree of nullity issued because consummation is the conclusion, if you will, of the covenant. It's the enfleshment of the covenant. Okay. Now, since marriage is an ecclesial reality, it must be for Catholics in the presence of the Church's minister. Okay. And for Catholics, it must be according to the form of the Church. Now, this was a requirement of the Council of Trent. Why? Why did Trent make that? Well, because you see, remember, what did we say in the West? Who are the ministers of the sacrament? The couple. Well, it was somewhat common, like in the Middle Ages, for a couple sometimes to just sort of vow themselves to one another by the light of the moon and exchange a ring or something like that. It was doubtless terribly romantic, but it's kind of tricky to know who's married and who's not married. Okay, and so that consequently the Council of Trent forbade secret marriages. Okay, marriages must be public. That doesn't mean it has to be a huge ceremony, but it means that it must, at least, there must be the priest and two witnesses. It might sometimes, like an older couple, it could be like a very discreet in a little chapel or something like that. It might not be a bit with a lot of fanfare, but the point is at least public means before the priest or the deacon and two witnesses. Yeah. A deacon is allowed. That's one of the things that a deacon can do. He's allowed to baptize. He's allowed to witness a marriage ceremony. He's allowed to do benediction of the Blessed Sacrament. There are many different things that a deacon can do and be a great help to the priest.
If the Catholic isn't marrying before a priest or a deacon, so outside the Church?
That's outside the Church. That's what I meant when I said that the Catholic is obliged to the form of the Church. So that the Catholic, in other words, what does that mean? That means that the Catholic is obliged to have a Catholic ceremony. Okay, and that normally takes place in the parish church, and that normally takes place in the bride's parish. Okay, now having said that, that's the norm. Okay, what's the norm? Well, the norm is the basic law for everybody. However, there can be dispensations. Is another parish more suitable than the bride's parish? Because maybe the couple met while working in New York City. Well, and she still goes back home to Ohio very frequently and considers herself a member of St. Patrick's Parish, but in fact, they're both living in New York and all their friends are New Yorkers. Would a parish in New York be more helpful? Well, a dispensation can be, or the pastor can give permission for that. The young Catholic man is marrying, let's say, a Protestant girl. Her family are not opposed to the fact that she's marrying a Catholic, but they just have all sorts of problems with it being a Catholic ceremony. Well, the Church used to insist on the Catholic ceremony. The Church now says that the bishop can give a dispensation for peace between the two families, let's say, that it could be a Protestant ceremony, or let's say an Eastern Orthodox ceremony, okay? But he needs, or this young man needs permission. You see, he's getting a dispensation from form. Supposing in another case, a Catholic woman marries into an Episcopalian family, and she marries the son of the vicar of St. Swithin's on the Green, okay? And the family's whole life has revolved around St. Swithin's ever since St. Swithin's was founded 150 years ago. Their family were deeply involved in that little parish church. The family have their heart set on this church. Where there are legitimate reasons, connections, it's the church will even dispense from the fact that it needs to be in a Catholic parish church. It can even be in a non-Catholic church. Or supposing, now this is a little different, the next case is not a sacrament, but supposing somebody marries a Jew or a Jewess, okay? A lot of Jews are just death on, first of all, they don't like their people marrying outside Judaism, yeah, which one can understand. I once heard a rabbi give a sermon in the synagogue when I had brought my class to the synagogue, and he pleaded, was pleading with everybody, every family there, husband and wife, to have one more child. It didn't bother him a bit that we were all there, Catholic onlookers. Bother him a bit. Because he was saying, if you people don't do that, he said, our race is going to disappear, as they're all intermarrying. And actually, it's very interesting. It's very tough for Jews to get a rabbi to be part of an interfaith marriage, because the rabbis are all opposed to them. Yeah. However, in a ceremony between a Jew and a Catholic, the bishop can even dispense from a religious building at all, because a lot of Jews don't want to go to, let's say, a Catholic church, and a lot of times Catholics don't want to go to a ceremony in a synagogue, and so that consequently he can allow the marriage to take place in a kind of neutral place, you know, like the country club or something like that. And that's not uncommon for Jewish Catholic weddings, okay? Now, there must be two witnesses. They may be non-Catholic. They don't have to be Catholic. Okay, an ex-Catholic is not an appropriate witness for your marriage. Someone who has left the church. Maybe they think they have reason for that in good conscience. I don't know. I can't judge such a thing. Objectively, one never has reason to leave the Catholic Church. But they would certainly not be appropriate as witnesses to a Catholic marriage. Yes.
I'm wondering if you do not get the dispensation to have a marriage at a Protestant ceremony, then what is the status of it?
It's not considered a sacrament. It's not considered a valid marriage. So the Catholic is not considered married. So let me give you the example of my cousins. Okay, I have two cousins. One, a young woman who had a lot of problems with the church, fell in love with a Presbyterian, married the Presbyterian minister in the Presbyterian church without any dispensation. She is not considered married by the Catholic Church. Her brother married a Congregationalist. The Congregationalist family had ties to their minister, their church. They were not adverse to the son marrying a Catholic, nor adverse to their grandchildren being Catholic, nor was she adverse to that. But nonetheless, she felt, and they felt, that the ceremony really needed to be Congregationalist. The Bishop of Providence gave a dispensation from place, therefore it was in the Congregationalist church, gave a dispensation from form, therefore it was a Protestant ceremony. I was delegated as the Catholic witness. Normally when there is a dispensation given to have the ceremony in another church, there's supposed to be a Catholic priest or someone designated by the church as kind of a witness for the church. I was designated. I did a scripture reading, gave a blessing at the end. Two, a brother and a sister married. Both married in Protestant ceremonies, both married Protestants. One with no dispensations, therefore, was not considered valid by the church. The other was considered a sacramental marriage by the church because the church was involved, and one was an ecumenical marriage, the other was simply a Protestant marriage that the Catholic had no permission for. Do you understand the difference? That's how the church sees it. Yes, Steve.
The church sees on those who, when the sacrament was invalid, they see them as putting it down.
Yes. Now, whether or not, but of course, when you talk about something like that, you're always talking about questions of conscience, knowledge, culpability. But if they really know the teaching of the church and they freely choose to ignore it, yes, the church does see them that way.
Can you have like two ceremonies? I know of a family, well, he's Catholic and she's Muslim, so they had first a ceremony before a mullah to please the family, and then later they had the Catholic wedding.
Mm-hmm. No, the church forbids that. I'm sure. The church does not allow a kind of double ceremony. Now, there are countries in Europe where the state requires a civil ceremony. In France, not in Italy, but in France, maybe Belgium, often good Catholics will go and have the civil ceremony, which they need to do for the state, but they will wait then a couple of days after to have this the church ceremony, and they show by that that they don't really consider the legal ceremony really all that important, but that the real ceremony is the church ceremony. Now, in this case, what perhaps the priest could have done, not so much approving of a double ceremony, which the church forbids, but if they'd already done one, then to help out this Catholic in this difficult situation, then in a sense, kind of bless the ceremony, bless the marriage, have a Catholic ceremony. Perhaps that's what happened. Yes, Michael.
What is this notion of by the power vested in the
I don't know. That's Protestant.
I know that's a different tradition, but what's the idea behind that? Like, that guy has power.
Well, I don't know. I guess from a Catholic perspective, we say he has the power to witness.
Okay.
I mean, I think probably even in the Protestant churches, they would tend to say, they probably say that the couple are actually the ones who are doing the marriage, so to speak. I don't think they'd say the minister does it. I think the minister is a witness. I mean, even though they've changed many things, nonetheless, their tradition is basically Western as opposed to Eastern. Okay. Now, If you want to get married, then you have to prepare for marriage. The pastor is the one who has the obligation of preparing you for marriage. But in most dioceses, the bishop as the chief pastor has made certain regulations. Normally, you need to kind of notify the church 6 months in advance. And various dioceses have various marriage preparation programs. In many places, the marriage courses that are offered at this university are accepted in lieu of that. And if you think that marriage is your vocation, it certainly wouldn't hurt to take a good marriage course here. Some have it worked out, so there are a series of instructions. Not infrequently, many places have a kind of engaged encounter weekend where a lot of the instruction is done over the weekend. Some places these marriage preparation programs are very good, and some places they're very weak. Frequently, people who've taken marriage courses here and then have participated in these others in different places have sometimes found them wanting. The Pope and the bishops, many bishops are trying to kind of strengthen these marriage preparation courses. Strictly speaking, according to canon law, they are recommended, but they are not obligatory. So that if a pastor feels that a couple, maybe for example, who've both taken marriage courses here, are sufficiently prepared, he can dispense them from that, or he can do his own instruction. They must be instructed, okay? But on the dignity of marriage, the sacrament of marriage. Yes, Jim?
What is the priest's precise obligation regarding the couple? And in my whole diocese, I see this problem. A couple that's cohabitating, especially quite openly with no hiding about it. And even when the diocese newspaper put a large article on it, there was nowhere in the article that it states that this was expressly sinful. And there was, in my mind, it seemed like such a hands-off. It was like the church was refusing to do its moral duty to proclaiming the good, the sacramental good, you know, and right of marriage. What are the precise obligations of the canon law or in the church?
I don't think there are any. So there are the pastoral obligations of calling sin, sin. In different dioceses, different synods of priests have grappled with this. In some dioceses, the priests have come up with like a policy of saying that we won't marry you unless you show your good faith in the sacrament of marriage by separating for a while, you see. But that is not like a kind of universal church law.
I think that a large part of the reason that marriage is founded so frequently in the country is that the pastors of the churches of all denominations have oftentimes surrendered their moral authority to say, I cannot bless this.
Well, that's why the church in Louisville, the Catholic Church there, has joined with a lot of different Protestant churches, and they've kind of issued a sort of a manifesto about marriage and the Christian institution of marriage and a pastoral practice that they will not marry people who are not prepared. They deal with the whole question of cohabitation. Now, it is interesting to note that there is a difference between so-called mixed marriage and what's called disparity of cult. Mixed marriage implies a Christian marriage, a marriage between two baptized, even though one may belong to a non-Catholic church, okay? Whereas disparity of cult is between a Catholic and someone who is not Christian. A Muslim, a Jew, Baha'i, something like that. Okay. Now, basically, for a mixed marriage, there must be the bishop's permission. And for the disparity of cult, there must be a dispensation. This presupposes that the couples agree that the Catholic has an obligation towards the baptism and education of the children as Catholics. In some places, they make the couple sign some kind of document. Many places will simply have the couple agree orally, or in some places it is simply put upon the Catholic party that the Catholic party will do all in his power to have the children baptized and raised as Catholic. See, now there's an interesting way. It's put all in the person's power, you see, which suggests maybe sometimes it may not be. There was a very celebrated royal case, Princess Michael, a German Catholic, married into the royal British royal family, I think the Duke of Kent. And by law, his children have to be raised Anglican, because there's some sort of distant possibility of succession to the throne. And she asked for a papal dispensation and could not get one because this condition was not present. She married an Episcopal or an Anglican ceremony and evidently argued that she had done all that she could, and eventually they were allowed to be remarried in the Catholic Church, so that she is now considered a Catholic in good standing. But that was the whole nub of the problem. Okay, so normally the Catholic has the obligation of raising the children in the Catholic faith, baptized in the Catholic faith, and raised in the Catholic faith. And basically, obviously, if one believes that the Catholic Church is the fullness of what Christ intended the Church to be, even though we respect whatever goodness and truth is found in other Christian churches, then it stands to reason that one wants the fullness of the faith for one's own offspring. Yes, Michael.
Cody and I got married to the family with a Christian, but she just got baptized last Easter. But I know for sure they don't know any of it. Does it matter? Do they have to...
Was he married in the church?
Yeah, they were married in a Catholic church.
Yeah. So what that means... Oh, well, that's odd. But what that means is, if she was not... Would you say she was not Christian?
She wasn't Christian at all.
Okay. Okay. So their marriage was not a sacrament.
Right. But is it now?
Yeah. She got baptized. Okay. Nothing changed except everything changed, because she got baptized. And what was not a sacrament, which was a good marriage, becomes elevated.
So they don't have to do anything official. Or horrible, right? Okay, good.
Peace.
This has been Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, a series of lectures bringing the classroom to you. Join us again next week for another lecture on the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church with your professor, Father Giles Dimmock. For more information on Franciscan University of Steubenville's Distance Education Program, call 1-800-446-8336. Or from outside of the United States, call 614-283-6517.